Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. We're going to speak with a Nobel Prize winner. We begin this hour. We're speaking to someone who is a Nobel Prize winner in football when the NC State Wolfpack do it to Notre Dame. That gets your attention when Dennis Gartman joins us. He's footballed out with his NC State. Mr. Gartman, good morning.
Good morning, and we did indeed beat Notre Dame, and we are 2-0 against the Golden Domers, and let's hear it for the Wolfpack.
And it's 4-1. Is this a better than good season, or is, you know, it's like easy games and you're going to get crushed later on, which is...
Yeah, it's been easy games and we're going to get crushed later. Okay. We have Louisville and Clemson coming, so it's not pretty. So we're happy to be 4-1, but logically we're at 4-3. It's one of those years.
Dennis, speaking of crushed, let's talk about trading in a range-bound market. Mm-hmm. It is a contact sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's interesting. Whether one talks about the S&P, the NASDAQ, whether one talks about the Russell, or whether one talks about the Dow Jones International Index itself, we have been in a trading range for the past month and one half. It looks like it breaks out to the upside. The next day it moves lower. And one day it looks like it's breaking to the downside, and the next day it moves higher. You get stopped into long positions and taken out. You get stopped into short positions and taken out. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 2 weeks, you've gone nowhere, and you've been stopped in and out four or five times. It's one of those periods that make it very difficult to be any kind of an investor or a trader.
This UNC Tar Heel is looking forward to the day after Thanksgiving when my heels take on the Wolfpack, but we'll leave it there.
Sorry, David.
We will leave it there.
We didn't want you to know, David.
I was very politely mute during that top of the special. Dennis, let me ask you about oil. We have had all of this news out of oil as this Congress is underway in Istanbul. It seemed like there was there were signs here that agreement in principle was going to become a real agreement. And then you had the CEO of Russia's biggest oil company saying he doesn't intend to cut production. So here we are a few weeks away from, the Tar Heels versus Wolfpack game, but also that meeting in Vienna. What are the odds here that something goes on to scuttle it before then?
I think there's a lot to say for this agreement to be scuttled, and I think that not enough importance is being put on Mr. Sechin's comments this morning. Sechin is a fellow that most Americans, or I would say 1 in 1,000 Americans, know who he is, but Boris Sechin is the head of Rosneft. He is a former KGB agent, has been a very close friend of Mr. Putin's, and as I've always said, once KGB, always KGB. This is a very savvy but, I think, a disturbing gentleman. And when Mr. Sechin said that he has no intention, why should he, of cutting production, if Russia's largest producer of crude oil has no intention of cutting production, no one else shall either. I think that it's always been a tenuous idea to think that OPEC could put forth and agree upon and then follow through on an agreement to curtail production. Sechin has simply put a top to it.
Given that closeness between him and Vladimir Putin, professional closeness, how do you explain the dissonance there between what he said today and what Vladimir Putin said in Istanbul yesterday, saying that he saw a freeze as the only way forward here?
It's been interesting because until about a year ago, what Sechin said, Putin said, and what Putin said, Sechin said. But for all of a sudden, in the course of the past year, it's as if they have become demonstrably less friendly. Now, one has to be a reader of Russian tea leaves to be certain that that's true, but no longer can one say that as goes Sechin, so goes Putin. There has been a seeming divorce between the two. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I have read, or that's what I read in the comments following both these gentlemen over the course of the past year. So I think there is some sort of dichotomy, some sort of divorce that has occurred. And I put credence in what Sechin has said. He has no intention, as the president of Rosneft, to curtail production.
Dennis, let me get to two trades. We'll come back and talk about gold. You've gone long corn. Corn has been ugly, ugly, ugly. I'm looking at the chart right now. Give me the why. How do you go stochastic on corn? You don't have a trend. It's been down. It's been flat since July. How can you go long corn? What do you see?
If for no other reason, corn refuses or has at least not made a new low in the course of the past month and a half. Yes, the chart, if you put the chart on the wall, walk 25 feet away from it, and were asked, what is that doing, you would say, my word, it's moving
to
the lower
left. Oh, my word,
left.
You know my strategy.
Yeah, it's from the upper left to the lower right. But it has failed to go to new lows, even as the size of the crop has gotten egregiously large. I mean, this is a record crop, whether it's 15.1 or 15.2 or 15.3 billion bushels.
Yeah.
Everybody everywhere knows that fact. And I have to think that that's fairly well discounted in the market.
Is that a structural record crop or is it a one-off? That's a critical question Midwest listeners.
Well, I think it's a structural record crop every year. Except for years when we have droughts.
Yeah.
One of the things that you can count upon is that we are going to produce more and more corn, more and more soybeans, more and more cotton, more and more wheat on less acreage. We just are very good at what we do.
Right.
American farmers are extraordinary. So, I think it is structural.
Dennis Gartman, you're where I am, which is, sterling's down. Folks, it's brutal. It's what, on a curved basis, is called log quadratic. Brutal, like Trichet says, and nobody's paying attention to Euro 110.78. Are you there yet, Dennis, where you can short Euro? And is it a short through parity?
Oh, I think it's a short towards parity. As I said in my newsletter this morning, we've broken through 111.50. We've broken through 111.
Yeah.
Now we're about to break through 110.50. And as I said, under 109.50, there be monsters, as they used to say on the old Mariners maps. Under 109.50,
well,
there be monsters.
Then that is critical. That leads to dollar strength. Is it at a dollar strength that impinges the American corporate system?
We are going to continue to see dollar strength. I don't think there's any question about that fact. And it does make it difficult, especially if you want to be bullish of corn, which I want to be, to allow for exports of American agriculture. I mean, that does make the game that much more difficult. It also makes us that much more, we become more competitive because the dollar is getting stronger and it's likely to continue to get stronger. Can the euro trade to parity? Well, I think it's over the course of the next year or two. I think that's a given. The political circumstances, the economic circumstances, the technical circumstances, the psychology mandate a stronger dollar, a much weaker euro. And if you have to pick on one currency, I think that's the one to continue to pick on.
Real quick here, you were talking 15.3 billion bushels of corn. Where's that corn going to? We're having this conversation about exports. Where are farmers sending that corn to?
Pigs, cattle, livestock, of course. Ethanol, which I've never been and never shall be a great proponent of ethanol, but it's going into ethanol production, and it goes into export trade. I mean, we are now at a point where the supply of corn is not the determining factor. It's the demand for corn, which will be the determining factor, and the problem shall be a strong dollar makes the exports of corn that much more difficult.
One thing Dennis Gartman and I have talked about, folks, in speaking engagements we've done, is what I call position sizing. Actually, Van Tharp calls it position sizing. I call it the how-muchedness. Mr. Gartman recently learned about the how-muchedness of being in gold.
I know that Tom is very eager to ask about gold, but just indulge me a second before we get to that. I wanted to ask you about the sterling flash crash that we saw last week, and you said it's taking up far more of our time than we think it merits, but indulge me a bit here. And if you peg this to sort of temporal illiquidity, are you worried it could happen again? I mean, this is something that would be recurrent then.
Well, I'm worried it can happen in the bond market. I'm worried it can happen in the grain markets. I'm worried it can happen again in the equities markets. We have the markets seem not to be nearly as liquid as they used to be. Graham Dodd, I think, has had a great impact taking any large number of banks out of the markets that used to be able to make markets on both sides. I fear flash crashes happening on a rather consistent basis in any number of commodities in any number of markets. So I was not surprised that it happened. I was surprised it happened in the Forex market, however, where there usually is greater liquidity than any place else.
Oh, come on. You're the next George Soros. You made a fortune. And now Dennis Gartman on the one-way bet or the one-trick bet. Dennis, you're in gold, and boy, has it been an ugly number of weeks. How do you deal? You know, first of all, you know, what's your biggest percentage exposure at any time?
I don't know. 50%, and I probably am there in gold and should not have been, no question. How does one respond? Well, after one stops throwing up, one gets smaller. One hasn't any choice. Thankfully, at least I was not long of gold solely in U.S. dollar terms. In fact, I don't own any gold in dollar terms. At least somewhat the loss was mitigated by the fact that I own gold in euro terms, which is down, but down demonstrably less than gold in dollars. Let's be honest. But has it been fun? It was fun early in the year. Has it been fun in the past month and a half? Oh, Lord, no.
If it's range-bound and you go down 2.1 or 2.2 standard deviations, do you rationalize regression to the mean? Do you go to cash? How do you reframe it down 2 standard deviations?
You get smaller. You reduce the size of your trade. You have no choice. That's what pros do. That's how you have to respond. You may come back and own it again later, but the first thing that one does is one gets smaller, and that's exactly what I did. I got smaller. Do I wish that I had gotten smaller before we had the collapse in gold prices in dollar terms 2 weeks ago? Of course I do. Have I increased my position since then? No, I have not. Am I interested again? Yes, because suddenly gold in euro terms, I see the euro getting weaker, and gold in the course of the past 48 hours has begun to show signs of strength. But is my confidence level high enough to say, let's go back and do it again? No, not yet.
So where do we go from here? We broke that 1250 barrier, fleetingly, on Friday. When you're looking at gold, what's your path forward?
In order for it to turn for the better, and gold, I think, has become solely a technical circumstance, not a fundamental circumstance, because let's be honest, in dollar terms, it's still up for the year rather markedly. In euro terms, it's up for the year very markedly. But I need to see gold trading above 1270 to say that the low has been seen. The fact that we broke under 1250 and saw no real new selling there, and I think most of the selling that occurred a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago was predicated on one, maybe two large funds being taken out by their own margin clerks.
Yeah.
If we get above 1270, I think you will have been able to say 1248 was the low. Hmm. Time shall tell.
But this goes also separately to the idea of trying to be informed and in place in the markets, but you're in a range. As you know, range dissipates capital. How does Dennis Gartman adjust when it's an obvious dollar range, oil range, gold range?
You get smaller, you get smaller, you get smaller, and you get smaller. I wish there was some secret that I could grant and say this is how one does it, but I think the only thing one knows how to do is get smaller and wait. That's what one does.
And I can't emphasize enough, folks, of reading the literature on trend-based mathematics, dynamics, to know what to do, and critically to know what not to do. That is half the battle. Dennis Gartman, as always, thank you so much. Love having you on. I will remind people that unlike most in the game, Mr. Gartman on a daily basis puts the gold and the gore of his trades in the back of his newsletter. That's how quaint. Very few people do that. Dennis Gartman, the Gartman letter. Joining us, and there's like 8 ways to go here, including the Nobel Prize on Contracts, Bent Holstrom, to join us in the next hour from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Stephen Ratner joins us from Willett Advisors. And Professor, I've got to go. You are Carzar, and even your most largest critics would like you to be debate czar or political czar.
They would?
With your broad-reaching skills, I'm trying to make it up as we go. What would you do to our broken political process? Do we just get beyond the first Tuesday of November?
I think we, at this point, certainly for this cycle, we get past the first Tuesday in November. There's whatever momentary thoughts people might have had that there would be a different Republican nominee are certainly by the boards. Mr. Trump is going to finish this race. Hillary Clinton is going to finish this race.
Presumably Hillary Clinton is going to win. That's what all the polls seem to say. And the Republican Party will have a lot of soul searching to do.
Within this, is we just mentioned with the NFIB report, the angst over a tepid economy. Did you hear any policy in debate uno or debate dos about economic policy and placing the nation on a better track or vector?
Shockingly little. This has been like a smoke-free zone. This has been a policy-free zone, this campaign. There were two questions, really, in the second debate that were pretty directly on policy, and then a few others that touched on it. One was, of course, about Obamacare and the debate and the discussion they had about whether to keep it. And the second one was about taxes and what to do about taxes and the difference between their two approaches. And then there was some happy talk about how we have to get the country moving again. And Trump would talk about unleashing regulation and letting the free enterprise system work. Hillary Clinton would talk about programs to help those left behind, to retrain them, to get them back in the workforce, to invest in infrastructure. There's a little bit of that around the edges. But for somebody who's a policy guy as opposed to a political guy, these debates are not very satisfying.
It was back in May that you wrote, "I'll bet there's plenty to learn about Donald Trump's taxes." Since then, the New York Times obtained the first three pages of his 95 return. That came up at the debate. He commented on it. What have we learned since? And in that broader conversation about taxation, where it might head under a President Trump or President Clinton, where do we stand?
I think Trump has done a pretty good job. I have to give him credit of having a line of response on his tax returns, which is to simply say, "Of course, I used all my deductions.
Why would not?
Don't you?
Right.
Does anybody in this room not use their deductions? I do." Then he goes on to say, "Therefore, I'm the only one who can fix it." But if you look at Trump's tax plan, it would not fix it. It would make it worse. He's proposing a $5.8 trillion tax cut over 10 years, which would vastly disproportionately go to the wealthy, including potentially, though they haven't really clarified it, giving the so-called pass-throughs, the LLCs that many businessmen, hedge funds, everybody operates through, a 15% tax rate. And so, in fact, you'd make it worse. Now, what's interesting about the two candidates is that neither of them has actually proposed tax reform. Hillary Clinton has proposed raising taxes on the wealthiest to pay for her programs. Donald Trump has proposed this massive tax cut. But nobody's actually talking, with some small exceptions. Hillary Clinton's for the Buffett rule. They both want to get rid of the carried interest for private equity, which is kind of a small dollar amount. But in terms of fundamental reform to prevent people like Donald Trump from doing what they did, nobody's talking about it.
Could I say that maybe giving them the benefit of the doubt here? That's because they have some awareness of the fact that Congress has not been working in concert with the administration for some time here. I wonder, looking ahead to whomever is elected president, what's going to make that relationship between the White House and Congress measurably better?
That is the absolutely most important question. Everybody is focused on this election, and not very many people are focused on what's going to happen after the election, which is that someone is going to have to try to govern. And you're almost certainly going to have divided government. Regardless of which one wins, nobody's going to have 60 votes in the Senate, which means that filibusters can occur. Paul Ryan is still going to have his hard, hard right caucus that won't pass anything. And it's going to be really, really tough for who's ever president. And that's the most scary part of this.
How did you respond when Secretary Clinton cited Spielberg and Lincoln in the amazing Congress at that time? I'm sure you saw the movie.
Well, I saw the movie. And what she didn't say is that the way that Lincoln got that amendment passed was by doing stuff that today is illegal. You cannot appoint your brother-in-law, whoever it was, the friend of the brother-in-law, to be postmaster general in Ohio.
Brilliantly
you just can't
said.
You can't hire two bagmen from Albany to go around with bags of cash to persuade people who are not on your team.
We do that with our advertisers all the time.
But the important point here is there are many people who feel that changes in the procedure up there that were meant to cleanse it, like getting rid of earmarks, actually may have made the problem worse because now the leadership has no way to reward people who actually do what they want them to do. And this has actually contributed to the gridlock. So what Hillary Clinton was saying was interesting, but there's no way to go and be Lincoln anymore. It doesn't work.
Stephen Ratner with us with Willett Advisors as we look at any number of linkages here. Stephen, within the equity market, you've always made clear you want to find good companies and hold them. If they're working with a new terminal value that's lower, if they're working with lower nominal GDP, if they're working with lower revenue growth, is there loads of room to go down the income statement and cut costs to get to better margins, even in a low single-digit world?
I'm not sure that there is. As you know, corporate profit margins peaked a year or two ago and then have been coming down, obviously heavily driven by energy, but other sectors as well. And if you look at corporate profits as a share of GDP, if you look at corporate profit margins, none of it suggests that there's a lot of room. At this point. And so we think our view has been, and we've acted on this, that the equity markets are very fully valued, that what is mostly propelling the U.S. equity market anyway has been lower interest rates. As and when that reverses itself, we think that the U.S. equity markets are going to be challenged. And so we have been actually reducing our exposure to U.S. equity markets.
You mentioned energy, and we've had a whirl of interest here in a production freeze over the last couple of weeks from OPEC participants and talk that might be formalized at the meeting in Vienna at the end of November. What effect is that going to have on equities, do you think, here in the next couple quarters?
Well, you can see already, obviously, in the energy markets that the price of crude has now gone up above 50, I think for the first time, or at least certainly for the most sustained time since the whole collapse in prices, and it hasn't really had any deleterious effect so far on the equity markets. I think what would hurt the equity markets would be if it appeared that there was some dramatic escalation in energy prices, but you still do have a supply-demand imbalance in favor of supply in terms of what's being produced every day. Maybe they'll succeed in cutting that. But after that, you have huge inventories, and those have to be worked down before there can really be a major impact on price.
We were talking with Catherine Mann of the OECD about economic participation, the degree to which people in the global economy feel left out by what gains we have seen. Let me try to dovetail this with politics a little bit. A few weeks back, there was polling indicating that Donald Trump was doing well with voters in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania. I wonder what you make of that. In your experience with the auto industry, these are places where that continues to play a large role. What more could Hillary Clinton, your candidate, do to speak to those voters? Why has she been able to reach them? Why has Donald Trump been able to get those voters on the matter of participation, highlighting the fact that there's been some exclusion here?
Look, one of the most shocking things to me from my experience in autos was to find out what was going on in Ohio, what was going on in Michigan, what was going on in Indiana, what was going on in these states with these workers, and what's happened to their standard of living, what's happened to their real incomes as auto companies have closed or moved jobs out of the country, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so the effect is real. And the question for these auto workers, these former auto workers, or for all the people down there who are suffering is, which candidate do you think is most equipped to help you? Do you think closing the borders, putting 25 or 35% tariffs on imports, and so on and so forth is the way to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. Or do you think we simply need to invest in the economy, invest in infrastructure, retrain these workers, and get the country moving again? Mm-hmm. That's the choice that's in front of the American people right this second.
Steve, I know you like to paint, and you know, you've painted your apartment like 14 times. If you want to watch paint dry, go to the IIF meetings at the IMF meetings. Is that enough alphabetical soup? And as you know, Steve, all the bankers get together and wax philosophical. That happened this weekend. And Mr. Dimon and Mr. Gorman, among others, said, okay, London's challenged. The assumption is we move to continental Europe or we move to Dublin. Wait a minute. We just may move back to New York. Can New York compete for London's business against Frankfurt and other Paris and other European destinations?
Look, I think there's a couple questions here. The first is, I'm not 100% convinced they're leaving Britain so fast.
I agree. Full disclosure.
Okay, yeah. So there we are. This is yet unresolved. Secondly, I'm not an expert on the so-called passporting and where these banks can operate from, but I would not have guessed that they could operate from New York for the same reason they won't be able to operate from Britain if they don't retain their passporting rights.
But that's one part of the basic idea of future growth.
Okay, but if passporting is not a problem, then why would they leave the UK in the first place?
I don't disagree, but I just thought it was an idea of saying New York can compete within the philosophical capitalism of Europe.
I would say as a former banker, it is hard. And it's not hard necessarily because of philosophical issues. It's hard because it is a basic rule of banking, in my experience, that the closer you are to the client physically, even in the modern world of technology, the better job you can do retaining.
Can you do a better job in Helsinki from London? or from Oslo.
I don't think they're going to Helsinki. I don't think they're going to Helsinki.
I'm just mentioning because we have the Nobel.
Maybe Amsterdam or Brussels or someplace that has good train service all over the rest of Europe. I don't know where they're going. I don't think they know where they're going.
Oh, come on. The train service of New York City can't compete?
It's a long way across the Atlantic in a train.
David, save me here.
Back to what we heard from the OECD, the fact that the fallout from that Brexit vote has not been as great as many had feared. Let's talk about the psychological fallout from it, what it says about the notion of globalization going forward.
The fallout on the pound has been pretty significant.
Sure.
Look, the Brexit vote and what got people scared here until Donald Trump began his self-immolation campaign, what scared people here is there clearly is, whether it's in Colombia, South America, or in Britain, or in the U.S., or in France, where you have Ms. Le Pen, you know, doing very well from the left, there is an undercurrent of people who are being left behind in the course of globalization. That's a fact. You can't get around that. And so the question is, are sane people going to offer a better alternative to avoid having people who are less stable implementing solutions that are almost certainly going to be disastrous?
Stephen Ratner, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Advisors, always good to have you here.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role is to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
It is not often, Tom, you talk to a chief investment strategist who is a classics major, magna cum laude graduate of Princeton University. We're talking about Scott Clemens, chief investment strategist, private wealth management at Brown Brothers Harriman. Eager to talk about that biographical trajectory, if we can, Scott. But let me start with the FTSE 100 today, reaching an intraday record. This, of course, on concerns about the government's approach to Brexit, what we've seen in the pound as well. A sign of more to come, do you think?
I think it is. It reminds us that Brexit is a process, not an event. And it's a process that's going to unfold in very unpredictable ways for the next couple of years. You know the background. Britain has not yet triggered Article 50, which starts the two-year clock to negotiate what Brexit actually means. As that happens, it's going to create more disruption along the way, I think.
You know, I think about the conversation surrounding the Brexit referendum. It was about immigration. Certainly, it was about the economy and regulation. As you begin to see these market focuses, market factors in play here, I wonder how that has shifted the conversation as you've observed it in the UK, seeing the kind of reaction we've seen in the pound recently.
Well, it certainly it raises the prospect of disruption. The uncertainty alone raises the prospect of disruption and reminds us once again that risk as investors is our stock and trade, no pun intended. It's our bread and butter. Risk is analyzable. Risk is something that we can measure and deal with. Uncertainty is a different creature, and because there's no precedent for what Britain has embarked upon, that uncertainty alone is going to create a lot of disruption. Now, having said that, for a disciplined investor, particularly for a value-driven investor, disruption creates opportunity. It's certainly something we're watching for in the UK markets. We haven't acted on it yet, again, because I think this process has got a while to play out, but I think it will create some opportunities. There will be winners, there will be losers, and valuations will give us the opportunity to take advantage of that.
Where are you on international investment right now, whether it's blue chip investment or something more obscure and EM-like? It's been a debate on surveillance about the amount and the further amount that should be put into international. Where are you on that, Scott?
You know, Tom, there aren't any low-hanging fruit opportunities in equity markets worldwide. Where we are finding them is in select emerging markets. And you guys know this. Emerging markets is the broadest of all possible brushes to paint with. It's a paintbrush we should put down because those markets could not be more different. But where we are finding opportunities selectively in emerging markets, we're allocating capital there. For the time being, the single largest equity exposure we have remains the U.S. market for reasons related not only to currency but related to just the opportunity set on offer.
You mentioned you're holding you're holding fire in the UK until something happens. Is that when Article 50 is triggered? What's the point at which you're going to be comfortable making a move there in the UK and maybe a bigger move in Europe?
Well, to be precise, we have some exposure to the UK and Europe already. What we would like to see in order to raise that exposure is disruption that comes from possibly a misstep in government decisions or something that hits the pound even further than it's already been hit. I'm not entirely sure what that would look like, but it would express itself. We're very much fundamental bottom-up investors, so it would express itself in a broader set of companies trading at a discount to what we believe to be the fundamental value, the intrinsic value of the business. So it's really more of a bottom-up indicator that we're anticipating than it is some macro effect that's going to show up on the calendar.
You've got a great chart in your research, and folks, I can't say enough about the density of the research from Brown Brothers Harriman. We protect their copyright. Don't email us for it. But with that said, the chart is extraordinary how this is not the Nifty 50s. We're almost beyond that. Some people say, no, it's not the valuations we saw then. You've got equity PE ratios just after World War II to now, 1 and 2 standard deviations. And we're basically there, Scott, aren't we?
Yeah. Tom, the
see
two
that?
Things that
if you're
worry
a classics
a
major
level.
From Princeton, you can do a one-word answer and
one
get away
answer.
With it,
yes,
even if it's
good.
Radio.
Yes.
The two things that worry me about the market right now is the combination of sluggish earnings growth and lofty valuations. The valuation concern is mitigated somewhat by low inflation and low interest rates, but I think the low interest rates are somewhat artificially driven by Fed policy, and I'm not sure I trust the low inflation numbers either. So from a top-down perspective, it concerns us. The bottom-up perspective, I think one of the graphs you're referring to, points to the narrow leadership of the market, which indicates that there are a wide variety of companies that are not trading at lofty valuations that do have earnings growth. I think this is that cliched stock picker's market, and it's uncomfortable, to be sure. And the opportunities are not as thick on the ground as they were 3, 5, and 7 years ago, but they're still there.
Scott, I want to crowbar out of you one really important topic. You're married to a music teacher. And how do you get kids to do the instrument? What's the secret sauce of getting offspring to actually do the given instrument?
You have to model it for them.
There you go.
They have to see you play and practice and struggle and succeed and enjoy. And that will be infectious, and they'll get it too.
There you go,
folks.
Example. Scott Clemens with us with Brown Brothers Harriman, who writes just a terrific, terrific, thoughtful equity piece across all markets. Scott, help me with the banks and the presumed cash flow. When we talk to the sell side, whatever their nuances of this bank or that bank, there's a general idea that the cash flow spigot opens X months out after penalties, et cetera, and it is a nirvana for banking. Do you agree?
No, well, that's a subtle question, but if I had to answer in a binary way, I would say no. I think the banks, and again, we're picking up a broad brush to paint with, the banks are still struggling to figure out what regulatory environment they're operating in. We're not going back to the pre-2008 type environment. That's still a process that's unfolding. And I think it's still unfolding. So I don't think it's as easy as just now that the penalties are done, the cash flow is back on. It's an area where there are selective opportunities, but nothing wholesale that we see in terms of the tide coming in.
David, do you understand that Mr. Clemens didn't understand it's binary Tuesday here? That's what we do on Tuesdays.
Zeros and ones.
That's the only questions we do.
Let me ask you here, Scott.
I didn't get that memo.
Here we are, at the beginning of the quarterly earnings season, and in your most recent note, you said the ultimate fuel for equity markets is corporate profits, and the fuel is running low. Give us your outlook here for these next few weeks as these earnings reports start to roll in.
Well, I think we're going to get yet another quarter of year-over-year declines in earnings, which by our numbers will be the sixth quarter in a row, which is unprecedented in the absence of an economic downturn. There are reasons why. We're late in an economic cycle. Corporations have exhausted the easy cost-cutting exercises. It's very difficult to grow your unit volumes when the economy is modestly expanding. It's very difficult to increase your prices when there's not a whole lot of inflationary environment. So the next boost to earnings growth, in my opinion, comes from the top line, from corporate revenues. And that's why I think the linkage to an economic variable is really important. Wage growth is probably the single most important economic variable to watch over the next 12 to 18 months.
What do you see there?
I think it'll start to increase. I mean, one of the big conundrums of this economic cycle is, as unemployment has fallen down to 4.95%, as we're adding jobs at a pretty healthy clip, you haven't seen any wage acceleration, almost as if the laws of supply and demand have been repealed. I just think, like so many other dynamics in this economic cycle, that's been protracted and delayed and prolonged. I think we're on the verge of beginning to see it. We may already be. Wage growth is up to 2.7%. That doesn't sound like a very big number, but it's the highest year-over-year number since 2010. So as long as we get a modest acceleration in wages, the psychological benefit to consumer spending will be good for the economy. It'll be good for corporate earnings as well. I think that's what's going to unfold over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, that modest raise, something that we were definitely talking about with the last monthly employment report. I'm wondering how this all plays into what the Fed is thinking, the degree to which you are thinking about what the Fed is thinking about at this point. We've been so consumed with central bank decisions.
Right, and I think wage growth is important as an influence on Fed decisions as well for two reasons. One, I think they would read accelerating wages as proof positive of tighter labor market conditions and success on the labor market front. And they would also see in it hints of future inflation. And I think those two things together would push them to raise interest rates at a more rapid pace than they have been, which isn't saying much, by the way. As I look at the Fed funds market this morning, the futures market's putting about a 68% probability on a hike in December. I think that's likely to happen. I think the Fed would like to raise interest rates. You saw at the September meeting of the FOMC, a vote of 7-3 to keep interest rates stable. So three voting members wanted to raise interest rates in September. So I think you're going to see higher interest rates over the course of 2017, and accelerating wage growth will give the Fed the rationale to warrant those hikes.
It's fascinating to me, and this is, Scott, with your great experience with this, help our audience with rising rates are good or bad for stocks. That's as basic as it gets. How do you address
that? Good question, Tom. It depends. Historically, the answer to that question depends on why rates are rising. So if rates are rising because the Fed is increasingly confident in the stability of economic activity, that's usually good for corporate earnings. That's usually good for stocks. Stocks tend to rise in that environment. I believe that's the environment in which we're likely to be. If, on the other hand, rates are rising because the market has concluded that the Fed is behind the curve on inflation, the Fed has lost its handle on the inflation part of the picture, that tends to be bad for stocks. I think we're more likely in the former environment. There's not a whole lot of overt inflationary pressure. There is sign of economic stability. There is rationale for the Fed to raise rates. I think the market will interpret that positively, and that'll be a tailwind for equities.
When you look at the cycle, where we are in the cycle right now, position us and give us your sense of where we're headed next.
Well, I mean, typically equity, you're talking the equity market David, or the economic cycle?
Equity.
I mean, typically the first stage of an equity market cycle, and they're all different in the details, but the first stage is driven by lower interest rates. We've been through that. I mean, that's been, again, very protracted in this cycle. The second stage of a cycle is one in which the market is more driven by rising earnings, even in an environment which interest rates begin to tick upwards. We're poised right now between those two cycles. So interest rates have fallen. They've risen the tiniest bit with the Fed rate hike last December. What we desperately need to see is that acceleration in earnings growth to power the next leg of this equity cycle. I expect that will unfold over the next 12 to 18 months. That's what I'm watching very carefully. And I think the primary driver of that is going to be this acceleration in wages that I'm anticipating.
Wonderful. We'd love to have you back. Scott Clemons, thank you so much. With Brown Brothers Harriman, greatly appreciated today. David Gura and Tom Keene in New York. David, some years the Nobel Prize is given in economics, and it sounds wonderfully accessible. I find it hilarious that Paul Krugman one year took the Nobel Prize, and most people didn't realize what it was for.
The column, right?
No, it's for the column, yeah. It's for his work with Donald Trump. No. That Professor Krugman redefined so much of our international economics and the discussion of it. Or some year, maybe somebody far more accessible, like Robert Shiller of Yale University, who has an esteemed career, but of course is acclaimed not only for the Case-Shiller real estate issues, but also, of course, irrational exuberance and gaming cycles and behavioral economics. We are honored to bring to you now worldwide Bengt Holmstrom of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor, good morning and congratulations to you and Professor Hart of Harvard. I loved the Nobel Prize summary of contract theory. And what was so great about it, and folks, I highly recommend, and I'll mention this in our time here this morning, the Tyler Cowen op-ed for Bloomberg View is lovely in explaining the importance of this award. To me, Professor Holmstrom, what's so important here is the exhausted state of America's workforce. We have a contract with employers around something you speak of, incentive intensity. Has digital technology, has the modern workplace changed our contract with our employers? Has digital technology changed your work of 30 years ago?
To the first question, I would answer yes. To the second question, no. I believe that the workplace is changing dramatically, and that that the old style contracts that have prevailed are under a lot of pressure in a number of professions. So, the work I did 30 years ago have actually, they are explicit contracts, as we call them, and so they are incentive contracts, and their relevance may be actually increasing now.
Within this, and folks, this goes back to Holmstrom Milgram of 1987, permeates simplicity. What I love about your work, and we've been making jokes this morning, Professor, about T beta equals F plus K beta, is Sanford Grossman is involved with your work, with Professor Hart of Harvard, with Joe Stiglitz of Columbia, with Joe Stiglitz's great work. Simplicity is everything. What is the simple message of contract theory that our audience needs to know?
I think the simplest message is that narrow incentives can be very damaging, and sometimes no incentives, that's financial incentives, shouldn't be used, because there are a lot of other mechanisms for incentivizing people, motivating them, having relationships, just observing them and making judgment and moving them, promoting them and designing their jobs. And so one of the things I think has been my contribution, mainly with Paul Milgram actually, has been to explain things in terms of a systemic approach to incentives as opposed to a single piece rate or something like that.
Has your work been forever changed because of the consultant-based madness of corporate CEO consulting and lawyers and management people? They've taken your simple original theories on trust and principal and agent and turned it into a cottage industry. Is that a problem?
It is a problem what they are doing, but I don't see it as them ever having paid that much attention to my book. And they certainly have not paid attention to the basic flaw in the incentive schemes, yeah, that prevailed after Enron revealed already, which was that they were just too shortly vested. You should vest them for a longer period. Instead,
right,
they started tampering with options, and they blamed options,
right,
and not understanding that the stock is actually an option itself.
Well, we'll get
they didn't either read it or misread it or whatever it is, but the CEO compensation, as I knew it in 2012 when I left boards, corporate boards, that it was a sorry state.
Well, let me bring in my colleague David Gurrow with the laureate Ben Holmstrom MIT.
Tom, I'm looking at the front page of the Boston Globe this morning. It is a pantheon of hometown heroes. You have Betts and Ortiz on the upper left, and just below them you have Hart and Holmstrom, smiling more broadly, I think, than the other two. You know, something that Tyler Cowen flagged in the column that Tom mentioned a moment ago, Professor, is that you have built a technical framework for other researchers to build on. You have been at the vanguard here of contract theory. When you look at your colleagues, when you look at your students and what they're doing, what are you most excited about in this field going forward?
I think the dynamic incentives that people are starting now, the young crowd that analyzing, you know, even more technically complicated but ultimately simpler mechanisms. I think that's an interesting book. And then applications of this, what we call multitasking, understanding that, you know, the job portfolio that people have greatly determine what you can do with explicit incentives.
Professor, one final question, and we'll let you go. You are of Sweden and particularly of Finland. What did you learn from the challenges of Nokia and Ericsson?
I learned that technology companies are vulnerable to change.
Well, we'll leave it there. Professor Holmstrom, congratulations. Greatly appreciate it. We're the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We'll do a lot more on this. I'll send some articles out. I just sent out it's 49 pages, David, and it's a absolutely spectacular walkthrough of how we got from early Hart and early Holmstrom, and even Robert B. Wilson, who was at Stanford ages before Holmstrom, how we got to where we are today, which is John Tucker's 85-hour work week. And was it 82 last week or 85?
It's going on.
Yeah.
And the contract theory clicked in.
There, yes.
The incentive intensity clicked in when? About Wednesday, 4 p.m.
I'm still waiting for that to click in.
And it was interesting what the professor said there. I mean, this is a huge deal. Not the work weeks of all Americans, but a subset of Americans working John Tucker hours.
The hardest working man at Bloomberg Radio.
You know,
I think
it is.
I'm gonna fight him for that. But
you're all in deep trouble. In this case.
You're very good, John Tucker. Thank you so much for opining after our conversation with Holmstrom of MIT, the Nobel laureate. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gurrow is at David Gurrow. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.